This is Our Americas, the weekly report on Latin America and the Caribbean. I'm Mario Murillo. In the next half hour, we'll have a report on the implementation of the Guatemalan peace accords. With the murder of a high-profile Guatemala City church leader and human rights activist last month, observers are concerned that the 1996 accords to end the war may be in jeopardy. Our Americas' Winifred Tate prepared a report. Then we'll talk to Emilio Betances about the death of José Francisco Peña Gómez, the longtime leader of the Dominican Revolutionary Party, the PRD, who passed away on May 10th, just a week before mayoral elections in Santo Domingo, which he was expected to win. All of this coming up next on Our Americas. On December 29, 1996, the longest-running guerrilla war in Central America came to an end with the signing of the Accord for a Firm and Lasting Peace between the Guatemalan National Revolutionary Unity, the URNG, and the government. 36 years of war had devastated the country, leaving at least 150,000 people dead and 1 million displaced from their homes. Entire communities were wiped out by the security forces, especially during the peak of the counterinsurgency campaigns from 1979 to 1982. Both Guatemalans and foreign analysts viewed the historic agreement as the opportunity not only to end the civil conflict, but to begin some of the structural reforms that are at the root of the social unrest. A series of agreements laid out commitments from the government and the opposition to address such issues as human rights, socio-economic and agrarian reforms, the reintegration of refugees and ex-combatants, indigenous people's rights, and a new role for the military in society. But as Our America's Winifred Tate reports, some recent developments have put the entire peace process in serious danger.
The killing of a Roman Catholic bishop in Guatemala late last month has shaken the country's confidence and plunged the civilian government into crisis. The death of Monsignor Juan José Girarde, a leading defender of human rights, marks the return of the demons of the war, according to one of the country's leading news magazines, Crónica. Some, like Frank LaRue of the Center for Human Rights Legal Action, believe the future of a civilian authority and the peace process itself are at stake. Girarde was beaten to death with a concrete block on April 26th, 2 days after making public the results of an exhaustive 3-year investigation sponsored by the Roman Catholic Church of human rights abuses during the Civil War. Entitled Guatemala Never Again, the church report estimates the toll of the conflict to be 150,000 dead and 50,000 disappeared, and says that about 80% of those casualties were caused by the Guatemalan armed forces. Since the murder, a number of leading human rights activists have reported death threats.
This brutal murder has been followed by death threats that have been received by the staff of the Archbishop's Office on Human Rights.
Carlos Salinas is the Latin American Advocacy Director of Amnesty International's Washington office.
Not only are the people that are directly involved in the human rights work who are involved in the public denunciation, in the lobbying, what have you, are they the ones receiving the death threat, but also people that are doing regular administrative work in that office. And it appears that this is could be a step back, going back to the periods where human rights workers were routinely assassinated and disappeared following this type of death threat.
Facing mounting public criticism and pressure to solve the case, the police are holding Carlos Enrique Vielman, a 24-year-old drifter with a previous criminal record for rape, assault, and public intoxication. But that action has merely fueled public suspicions that a cover-up is underway and that the real perpetrators of the crime will go unpunished. According to relatives, Vielman has a deformed right arm which makes it almost impossible to lift heavy objects like the concrete block that was used to crush Girarde's skull. He is also slight and frail, in contrast to the tall bishop, and he does not resemble the official police sketches of the murder suspect. For their part, the URNG issued a statement condemning the killing, saying that it was a deliberate attempt to destabilize the country at a particularly critical moment and will have serious consequences for the peace process. Hugh Byrne has been following these developments for the Washington Office on Latin America.
The way in which it'll affect the peace, is affecting the peace process, I think, is in the sense of the confidence that people have that something important is changing in Guatemala. I think that's really what the peace process represents. The sense of moving from a very exclusive, very repressive society to a more open and democratic and participatory society. And that depends on people being having really, I think, faith and trust and hope, sort of faith that the country has left behind the sort of repressive days that are documented in the Archdiocese report that Bishop Hirady was responsible for, that those days are in the past. A sort of trust that that after these 36 years of war, that it's possible to compromise with former enemies and opponents, that there's a different way of doing politics, really. And really hope that, I say, political participation and some sense of justice can replace the exclusion and the impunity that has existed for decades.
However, the implementation of the Accords has faced serious challenges and criticism well before the murder of Monsignor Hirady. In January, the URNG issued the third and most critical report about government compliance with the peace accords. They charge that the government is dragging its feet over crucial reforms. URNG International Representative Adrian Zapata spoke with Our Americas in Washington. Zapata says the government's delays have serious consequences.
Y en eso se empiezan ya a manifestar las oposiciones, los obstáculos. La resistencia de los sectores tradicionales de poder.
Conservative sectors are resisting two of the major reforms. The first is the constitutional reforms mandated in the peace accords to give them a legal foundation. Right now, the accords are merely a political agreement requiring a legal basis. Secondly, they're opposing the fiscal and tax reforms. This is very important because the accords are about the strengthening of the state and the state's fulfillment of its social responsibilities in social and economic development. The state must be financially stronger to play this role. It must have a larger income. So we must have fair reforms, progressive reforms, not more indirect taxes on the poor. Guatemala has one of the lowest tax rates in Latin America, and it's time for the dominant classes to pay what they owe.
Retardar indefinidamente la realización de estas reformas constitucionales, con el objetivo de dejar a los mismos sin un sustento jurídico.
Hugh Burns of the Washington Office on Latin America says these delays are part of a larger strategy of political manipulation.
It's essential that the constitutional reforms agreed to in the peace accords be passed very quickly, because they're the basis for all of the other legal changes that need to be made to really carry out the agreements of the peace accords. The main right-wing opposition party, the Republican Front of Guatemala, Efraín Ríos Montt's party, the dictator from the early 80s, leads that party. They're sort of holding the constitutional reforms hostage to a reform of the constitution which would allow him to run for president. At present, the constitution doesn't allow people who've been involved in coups to run for president. So they're saying, yes, we'll pass the other constitutional changes, but you've got to pass this one. And obviously people don't want to see that happen.
Another issue is the historic disparity of wealth in Guatemala. According to the United Nations, 70% of arable land is owned by less than 3% of the population. For the URNG, land reform remains a major issue. Once again, Adrián Zapata.
En cuanto a la cuestión de tierras, ese es el otro problema que quería señalarte. Los acuerdos de paz establecen también un rumbo para enfrentar.
The accords also establish a path toward agrarian reform, and this would contribute to a political solution to the structural problems facing Guatemala. Something has to be done to deal with the problem of resolving the chaos of untitled land. However, large landowners remain mired in legal squabbles, wanting to impose legalistic mechanisms to the agrarian conflict, which will only provoke more social conflict. For us, agrarian problems must be resolved in the spirit of the accords, with the mechanisms established there.
Legalistas a los conflictos agrarios, y estas soluciones legalistas lo único que provocan es mayor conflictividad social. Para nosotros,
Sister Alice Zuckman, who has directed the Washington-based Guatemalan Human Rights Commission for the past 15 years, traveled to Guatemala earlier this year. She says many rural Guatemalans have yet to see the impact of the peace accords signed December 1996.
I was in Guatemala in February, and I went out to the countryside, and almost everyone that I spoke to out in the countryside said, we haven't felt anything about the peace accords. We haven't felt the positive aspect of the peace accords. We don't have land. Our poverty is increasing. Our wages haven't really increased. And so it seems that most of the implementation of the accords is affecting the people that are in Guatemala City. but not the people, the indigenous people in the countryside. You know, we talked to many from that were in Congress now, like Lynette Montenegro and Milcar Mendez, who were, you know, really strong popular leaders and then were elected to Congress, and Rosalina Tuyuk and Manuela Alvarado, who are indigenous women. And it was pretty much the same, you know, the same message is that, you know, the peace accords are good, but we're not being able to implement them the way we would like to see them implemented. And we have to struggle really hard in order to, within Congress, you know, to bring out the issues that pertain to the majority population.
Another major issue is the role of the Guatemalan security forces. The peace accords established the demilitarization of Guatemalan society by dissolving the infamous civil patrols established in the early 1980s by the army. The government also agreed to remove the army from public security functions and reduce its personnel and budget by a third. It agreed to create a new civilian intelligence agency to handle internal security matters and to professionalize and transform the current police into a new civilian body. The peace accords also provided for a truth commission to investigate 36 years of human rights violations during the armed conflict. The agreement has proven controversial, however. According to the mandate, the Clarification Commission will only determine institutional responsibility for human rights violations. The commission will not be allowed to name names, as did the Truth Commission in El Salvador, nor will the findings be linked to judicial actions that will bring the accused to trial. The Clarification Commission is scheduled to release its findings in early July. But following Bishop Haradi's murder only 2 days after the release of the church's report, analysts are even more concerned about the possibility of further political violence. Once again, Hugh Byrne.
Some people say it's a message to the Truth Commission to, you know, a warning not to name names. I mean, they're not allowed by their mandate to name names, but that's still somewhat in dispute about how far they can go in assigning responsibility. Some people think that this was a message to the Truth Commission. But on the other hand, I think I've talked to people at the Commission in the last few days, and they've said, you know, it makes us really understand how important our report is going to be, how crucial it's going to be for the peace process. So I think it's really pulling people together in that respect. And I think the Truth Commission report is going to be extremely important for the post-process of peace and reconciliation in the country.
Meanwhile, attempts to clarify the U.S. role in the civil war continue. On May 11th, Congress held a hearing about the Human Rights Information Act. This bill would order U.S. foreign policy and intelligence agencies to release within 150 days all human rights records regarding activities occurring in Guatemala and Honduras after 1944. Thus far, President Clinton has supported in principle the provision of information to victims and survivors of human rights violations. However, most of the documents released so far have come from the State Department, while defense and intelligence agencies have not been so forthcoming. Even more troubling, much of the information remains hidden, even on publicly released documents, as large sections have been blacked out. Carlos Salinas of Amnesty International has been lobbying Congress to pass the Human Rights Information Act.
The release of information could help pinpoint, you know, certain patterns, types of brutality, certain modus operandi of different groups. So in one sense, the Human Rights Information Act can help prevent such crimes by exposing those cowardly killers who engage in this type of atrocity. The Human Rights Information Act can also help families heal, especially in the case of disappearances and identifying the locations of mass graves or identifying where certain people were disappeared to. And in that sense, it can help families heal and recover in some measure from this violent trauma that these atrocities in both countries, in Honduras and Guatemala, left behind. And finally, insofar as this helps this reconciliation process, families healing, and it could help the prosecution of those who have engaged in these vile acts, obviously then the Human Rights Information Act can strengthen democracy. You cannot have a democracy without the rule of law. And you can't have rule of law with impunity. When there is a pattern, as there is in Guatemala and Honduras, of those who engaged in such crimes escaping punishment altogether.
For Our Americas, I'm Winifred Tate reporting.
In other news this week, one of the Dominican Republic's leading political figures is dead. José Francisco Peña Gómez died on May 10th after years of battling with a number of ailments, including cancer. The longtime leader of the opposition Dominican Revolutionary Party, or PRD, Peña Gómez was favored to win the position of mayor of the capital, Santo Domingo, in elections scheduled for May 16th. He died of a lung edema at his home in San Cristobal, 20 miles south of Santo Domingo. The PRD said Peña Gómez went home after canceling a campaign event because he felt unwell. He also suffered from stomach cancer and had been operated on 3 times. Peña Gómez was a tireless defender of the poor in his earlier years in the Dominican Republic and was a leader of an uprising that provoked a U.S. invasion of the country in 1965. The black opposition leader never fulfilled his dream of becoming president in the Caribbean nation, where the white political and economic elite often use racist attacks for their political advantage. Joining us now to talk about Peña Gómez's legacy is Professor Emilio Betances, who is the director of Latin American Studies Department at Gettysburg College and a regular contributor to Our Americas. Emilio, to begin with, maybe you can tell us what you think that this death, the death of José Francisco Peña Gómez, means for the political landscape in the Dominican Republic.
The landscape has already begun to change. You know, during the burial of Peña Gómez, there was, when President Leonel Fernández came over there to the burial, people booed him and attacked him with oranges and eggs. And the contrast, however, is that people applauded Balaguer when he went to see the body of José Francisco Peña Gómez. You see, what has happened is that lately, you know, say over the last 2 months, there have been some approaches between the Peña Gómez. There was some approach between Peña Gómez and Balaguer. And Balaguer began using a lot of symbolism, like saying, for example, we have to eat rice and beans, and I don't eat by myself. I eat with other people. And he was referring to the PLD, to those who eat alone, and the term used there is come solo. And in the Dominican culture, to be a come solo, somebody who eats alone, you think of that person as a dog. And this has made terrible, you know, impact on the population. Now the death of Peña Gómez is going to add even more. You see, cultural factors have it that people tend to vote for people who are kind of the underdog, and Peña Gómez was the underdog. He lost the elections in 1996 because Leonel Fernández allied himself with Balaguer, and subsequently, Leonel Fernández and his people turned to be come solos, or those who eat alone, a term which Balaguer has created. Now, this issue of the come solos and the death of Peña Gómez has led already to change the political landscape. Firstly, somebody has been chosen to replace Peña Gómez, although his name will continue in the ballot. This is Johnny Ventura, a very famous merengue singer, but who also has been involved in politics and who is a lawyer himself, has been involved in politics for quite some time. Peña Gómez's wife will be the vice mayor of Santo Domingo. She has already been chosen for this. But the most important thing is that the death of Peña Gómez can be very symbolic in throwing a lot of votes to the PRD and taking them away from the PLD. Already, as Mario indicated earlier, Peña had over 50% of the votes for the district of Santo Domingo. And similarly, Milagro Ortiz Bosch, another member of the party, was a favorite candidate with 53% of the votes for the district of Santo Domingo, for senator. This indicates, you know, that the PRD stands to benefit from this election.
I just want to remind the listeners that we're speaking with Professor Emilio Betances, who is the director of the Latin American Studies Department at Gettysburg College in Gettysburg, Pennsylvania. He's a regular contributor to Our Americas and the author of numerous books on the Dominican Republic. I just wanted to look back. I mean, you just talked about the fact that they're trying to put a stop, the PRD, the opposition, is trying to put at least some kind of brakes on the neoliberal program of the governing PLD and Leonel Fernández. But maybe you can talk about the kind of transition that Peña Gómez made, the transformation, if you will, from being a complete advocate for the poor in the 60s and 70s to basically embracing, to a certain extent, some of the policies which Leonel Fernández is now being criticized for taking out. Maybe you can give us kind of a general history, briefly, of Peña Gómez's transformation.
Let me see if I can give you some elements to understand the meaning of Peña Gómez in the Dominican Republic. As you mentioned, Peña Gómez is a man who comes from having very early, humble beginnings. You know, he was, he's a descendant of Haitians, whose parents fled to Haiti, and then a Dominican family took him as an adopted child in 1937. And from there on, he started up his career first as a teacher, later as a radio announcer, and then a politician, a lawyer, and so on and so forth. Now, Peña Gómez was never identifying himself with Marxism or any kind of revolutionary politics in that extent. He was always a nationalist, a social democrat. As the public may know, Peña Gómez was one of the main leaders of the International Socialist, and he was a Latin American leader of that political current. And that is very significant. It is also very significant that Peña Gómez has been the only black who has occupied this position in Latin America. Perhaps he's the only black in the 20th century, not only in the Dominican Republic, but for that matter, in most of Latin America, where he has stood out as such a great leader. Now, but for us in the Dominican Republic, his blackness is not the fundamental thing. The fundamental thing is that he has made a great contribution to liberal democracy. You know, that is where we should look at the role of Peña Gómez. You see, when the PRD broke in two parts, first in 1973 when Bosch left the party, Peña Gómez remained behind. And it is after 1973 that the PRD becomes a pro-system party, with the PLD leaving with Bosch and becoming an anti-system party during the 70s. Then after the late 70s, the PLD is going to become a party of the system. So what Peña Gómez was fighting for in the 70s was in trying to get rid of Balaguer, but not proposing an alternate system of government as we had it during those years, you know, that socialists and communists were proposing. Now, Peña Gómez then, his transition was not one from being a revolutionary socialist, but rather, you know, I would say his transition was from becoming a liberal, a socialist, to a more conservative mainstream type of politician. And in that regard, his promotion of liberal democracy was always his goal. So he didn't make any transition. He never renounced democracy. He was always a pro-liberal democracy type of politician. So the other thing is that within his party, the currents which wanted to make alliances with the left, he always kept them in check. But he also kept in check those who wanted to make alliances with the right. So the PRD was like a federation of political currents from the left to the right. And the ability of Peña Gómez was to be able to play out all these different forces and try to control them so they would not tear the party apart. And what I would say is significant in terms of Peña Gómez's promotion of liberal democracy is that he was, you know, a person that would put the needs of the party and the needs of the country ahead of his personal needs. And perhaps this is something that will teach a lot to the Dominicans, you know, everywhere, but particularly to Dominicans involved in politics in the Dominican Republic. This is his greatest legacy. So when we talk about a transition, first and foremost, Peña Gómez, you know, was pretty consistent with his type of politics, you know, of promoting democracy within the capitalist system. And I would say that Peña Gómez, unlike most Dominican politicians, again, was one which had a lot of respect for others, and this is something that I think is in his legacy. Now, this issue of race, which has been raised in the Dominican Republic by Balaguer and by others in the Dominican nationalist groups who are essentially anti-Haitians, but no, you know, nationalist in the traditional sense, this is a kind of pseudo-nationalism, which is only raised when it's convenient for the political moment. The issue of race, while important in showing that this is a man of Haitian descent who has been able to make it in the political system, that is important. You know, as I mentioned earlier, Peña Gómez is perhaps, is, at least in the Dominican Republic, the only black civilian politician that have made what he has made. Perhaps, you know, this is unique at the Latin American level.
Professor Emilio Betances is the director of the Latin American Studies Department at Gettysburg College in Gettysburg, Pennsylvania. He's a regular contributor to Our Americas. On April 7th, 1995, about 3 years ago, I had the pleasure of speaking with Jose Francisco Peña Gómez. He was in New York during a visit for medical reasons, and I had the chance to sit down with him for about a half hour, talking to him about a number of developments in the Dominican Republic. One of the questions I asked him was to respond to his feelings about the United States, specifically given that it was the anniversary of the U.S. invasion of the Dominican Republic, and he told us this.
En el año de 1963, cuando se produjo la intervención para impedir el regreso al poder del profesor Bush.
In 1965, during the intervention that took place to prevent the democratically elected president Juan Bosch from taking power, the United States was caught up in the Cold War and the threat to its interests of the ever-powerful Soviet Union. It was, using an English term, an overreaction on the part of the U.S. and a great mistake that brought back to our national territory and our country the Trujillismo that the Dominican people had expelled from power 3 years earlier. Dr. Balaguer, the last puppet president of General Trujillo, who was exiled in the U.S., found a way out of his exile and returned to the country to take power on the heels of the glorious constitutional revolution that was spearheaded by the Dominican Revolutionary Party. He erased the constitutional order that the election of Juan Bosch should have established. The price on human lives for the country has been great. We lost many of the greatest fighters of the struggles for democracy of the time that were sacrificed, that died as guerrillas or on the streets, assassinated or were forced to live in exile. It was an entire generation that was sacrificed, and although finally, thanks to major effort on the part of the Dominican people, we are finally living in a democracy. Yes, an unstable one, but nonetheless, a democracy. And it was only possible at a tremendous cost. And now, 30 years later, we find ourselves in transition.
José Francisco Peña Gómez, dead at the age of 61 in the Dominican Republic. And you're listening to Our Americas, the weekly report on Latin America and the Caribbean. And that's about all the time we have on today's program. Our Americas is produced at the studios of WBAI Pacifica Radio in cooperation with NACLA, the North American Congress on Latin America. Associate producers are Sarah Gill, Amy Standen, Laura Tarantini, and Walter Krockmal. And thanks to Winifred Tate and Jose Santiago, along with Emilio Betances. If you have any questions or comments for us, you can write to us at Our Americas, P.O. Box 1091, New York, New York, 10116. That's P.O. Box 1091, New York, New York, 10116. For Our Americas, I'm Mario Murillo. Thanks for listening, and stay strong. Yeah.